The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Hospital that travels by sea to provide free health care in developing countries. On that sweltering afternoon, Welsh was on a break from her volunteer duties and had just ordered a drink at a liquado stand when she felt a tug on her shirt and looked down into the eyes of a 6-year-old child. Her name was Daisy. Daisy had no shoes but numerous infected cuts on her legs and feet, bald spots on her head, chicken lice and poor nutrition had caused her hair to fall out, and leathery skin from too much sun. She seemed scared and apprehensive, but had mustered up the courage to ask Welsh, whose warmth and kindness is palpable, if she could have her drink. Towering over Daisy's small frame, Welsh began urgently scanning the street for the child's mother when she spotted a group of street kids nearby waiting for their youngest friend. She asked the oldest, an 11-year-old girl, what was going on. The kids were homeless, sleeping on cardboard boxes in alleyways. I had never witnessed human suffering in that manner. Tangible human suffering everywhere in front of your face, says Welsh. I was completely heartbroken by it. That night, Welsh couldn't sleep. She felt ashamed of the evidence of better fortune around her on the ship, plenty of food and beverages and air conditioning. The next day, she started visiting and volunteering at the local orphanages, but none had space to accommodate Daisy and her family of friends. Welsh visited Daisy and her crew as often as possible, providing them with as many supplies as she could collect, including shoes, which they wanted above all else because of the difficulty of treading the boiling, trash-strewn streets without them. But 6 months later, the time came for Welsh's ship to set sail, and it left her raw. The last time I saw her before I left, I knew it would be the last, Welsh says of Daisy. I couldn't do anything for her. I couldn't get her into an orphanage. It ate me forever, and I had terrible dreams about her all the time. She was a beautiful flower that was never watered, says Welsh, pointing out the irony of having such a soft name in such hard circumstances. She never got to actually bloom. But her memory is the reason so many others have. With Daisy both haunting and guiding her, Welsh returned to the United States, cradling the determination to help youths in similar circumstances. After landing back in Kansas City, Missouri in 2002, Welsh ran a martial arts school of 250 students, where she taught life skills alongside self-defense. During a unit on compassion, she told her young pupils about Daisy, and they were inspired to take action on behalf of kids like her. "Why don't we do something?" they asked. That prompted the first board breakathon, which Welsh describes as karate chopping as many boards as you can in 30 seconds. They got sponsors and raised an impressive $5,000. With that initial influx of cash, Welsh boarded a plane for San Diego and crossed the border into Tijuana, Mexico, her grandmother's native land, to establish partnerships with local orphanages. "I wanted to be in a place that was easily accessible for volunteers to travel and serve," she says. When she visited various locations in Mexico, she says, "I started asking questions like, how many kids do you support? Where does your funding come from? What are the standards of the home? How can we help?" Returning home, Welsh reached out to several school districts, local and nationwide, to team up on more breakathon fundraisers, which generated $40,000 that first year, and then over the next 3 years, a staggering $250,000. Welsh took those funds to Tuni, India, where she teamed up with local organizations after a devastating tsunami in 2004 left more than 250,000 people dead and hundreds of orphans in the streets, and provided long-term funding and resources to a shelter of 40 kids. Today, some of those kids have amazing stories, like going to engineering or nursing school. "In the early 2000s, I wanted to put my efforts overseas because I knew how far I could stretch the dollar to help as many children as possible, and there was such grave need," she remembers. "At that time, I wasn't yet aware of the extreme forms of suffering from poverty, abuse, and parental neglect in the United States. Youth homelessness is an enduring problem that is sometimes hard to quantify in the United States. In 2020, the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Homeless Education reported 1.28 million homeless students in the 2019-2020 school year, while the Department of Housing and Urban Development identified only 106,364 homeless children under 18 and 45,243 homeless young adults 18 to 24 in a 2020 report. According to reporting in NPR and the New York Times, the wide gap is due in part to HUD's narrow definition of who counts as homeless. People living in shelters, transitional housing, or on the street, missing the hidden homeless who couch surf with various family and friends or live with families in cars or squatting in abandoned buildings. Welsh adds, the problem with the statistics on youth homelessness is that teenagers don't want to say that they're homeless. There are so many kids that are flying under the radar. In fact, a study in 2017 showed that 4.2 million kids experience some form of homelessness each year, and African Americans are 82% more likely to experience it. Globally, homelessness in both developed and developing countries, affecting all age ranges, has seen an alarming rise over the past 10 years. According to the United Nations, which denounced its first ever resolution on homelessness in 2020, and youths, they report, are the most vulnerable to becoming homeless. But back in 2005, after returning from India, Welsh reached out to local shelters in Kansas City because she wanted to understand the issues in her own backyard. Internationally, you'll see a homeless kid starving on the street. Domestically, they may have food and shelter, but they are starved for support and affection. The recurring refrain I heard from leaders at local youth shelters in Kansas City is that the kids age out of the shelters and then have no place to go and no resources, she says. That's when she officially founded HALO, which stands for Helping Art Liberate Orphans, a nonprofit whose mission is to create homes, healing through the arts, and education for teens aged 16 to 21 and their dependents. A foundational experience in Honduras informs the art component of the organization. The 42-year-old mother of three recalls bringing a collection of coloring books, crayons, paints, and papers to a local orphanage. She says she'd say to the kids, "Let's do a painting of yourself. Let's do a painting of what you want to look like when you grow up. Let's do a painting of someone who you know cares for you." It just cracked open everything for the caretakers with the kids. Art is a great tool for healing. The housing piece, Welsh explains, isn't just about providing basic shelter. It offers something far warmer and richer than that, the foundation of a family. Currently, HALO operates 6 HALO programs in Kansas City and Jefferson City, Missouri, with plans to expand into New York City, Nashville, and St. Louis in the coming years. The organization also runs 11 facilities, which include homes and educational centers in 5 countries, India, Kenya, Mexico, Uganda, and the United States, serving over 3,000 youths with 300 committed volunteers. All HALO homes, domestically and internationally, are part of a learning center that serves members of the entire community. A young person can come in and learn a trade, like becoming a tailor or a mechanic, but also life skills like opening a bank account, using public transportation, and interviewing for a job. We do anything that a family would do for them, teaching them how to make their bed or showing up for their graduations, Welsh says. But Welsh has an even greater vision. There should be a HALO home in every community that needs one, just like there's a food bank or a community health center, she says. Help from monthly donations and volunteers can inch her toward her dream, but to really make a dent in the growing youth homeless crisis, she is seeking major philanthropic partners to infuse the current system with desperately needed resources. Adding pointedly, we cannot as a society expect for them to pull themselves up by their bootstraps if they don't even own a pair of boots. One of the major challenges she encountered when trying to start HALO 17 years ago, in fact, was the poor opinion people held of the bootless population she sought to serve. Well-respected members of our community felt the kids were a lost cause, she remembers. I was like, no, all they need is someone to come into their lives and say, you can do this, and we've got your back. The way Welsh sees it, 50% of her job is helping people realize that we're all here for a reason and we all have something to give, and it's a gift to be able to give it, she says. That includes convincing potential volunteers that their time is an impactful contribution and that whatever skill they have is worthy. Looming, mowing the grass, making potato soup, or bringing over a casserole, all skills are needed and welcome. Our next article by Carrie Tyree is titled, After Logging 10,000 Hours at a Crisis Call Center, Here's What I've Learned. I have worked at a 211 Big Bend, a crisis center and information referral line in Tallahassee, Florida, since 2000. I've logged about 10,000 hours on hotlines, but I still never know what to expect when the phone rings. My goal, however, is always the same: make an authentic connection. Each conversation is different. I introduce myself first and ask callers their name. Some immediate questions need to be answered, like, have you hurt yourself already, to determine whether a situation is high risk and if we need to send help. Usually I ask open-ended questions. Can you share what you're going through? What's brought you to this decision? I paraphrase things the caller says so she knows I'm hearing her and because it gives her clarity. But there are instances where the first thing someone says is, I've got a gun, I'm going to kill myself. What are you going to do to make me change my mind? The situation needs a different tactic. I might say, it sounds like you've made up your mind, but I just picked up the phone. What about giving me a moment to hear what you're going through? I just try to focus on taking care of the person while I have him on the line. My longest conversation was 3.5 hours. Normally, we don't hang up until a positive outcome, like a caller's promise not to harm himself today, has been reached. The holidays aren't busier than any other time of year, but we do see spikes after high-profile suicides or a larger crisis. When Hurricane Michael hit Florida in October, we had a 400% increase in calls. And I don't spend every second of my day trying to keep someone in crisis alive. We have active callers who are lonely and just want to connect with another human being. We also hear from people looking for resources or food. That's how I came to the hotline. 25 years ago, I was in a diving accident that broke my neck. I called for information about transportation, but the young woman who answered just knew I needed to talk. We had an hour-long conversation, and she helped me get back on my feet, so to speak. This work still fills my cup all the time. Our next article by S.E. Cup is titled, I'm Pro-Life, and I Believe Roe v. Wade Should Not Have Been Overturned. For as long as I can remember, I've considered myself pro-life. I'm a center-right conservative. 25 years ago, I was drawn to the conservative movement and a Republican Party that seemed empowering, even and especially for women. Economic policies that removed barriers to entrepreneurship, cut government waste and regulations, promoted democracy and its freedoms around the world, lowered the debt and deficit, all seemed to be right and good for everyone. A rising tide lifts all boats, as the saying goes. I wasn't really animated by the social issues, and there were parts of the platform I didn't agree with. I'd always supported gay rights and found that to be conservative, too. If we want the government out of our private lives and to promote the institution of marriage, this only made sense to me. Republicans and many Democrats at the time did not agree. I opposed capital punishment. It didn't seem just or conservative to support government-sponsored killing, especially when the government could falsely convict someone. And I was pro-life, but in a way I knew was very different from many in my party. I wasn't religious. In fact, I was a devout atheist. I supported religious freedom and defended Christian America, but was also highly suspicious of its undercurrents and motivations. My version of pro-life found the procedure to be lamentable and sad from the position that the deaths of tens of millions of unborn babies couldn't possibly be a society's best answer to unwanted pregnancies. I wished for better alternatives and bemoaned where the left seemed to promote and celebrate abortion as an expression of women's liberation. But I didn't hate or judge women who made that agonizing decision. I'd known women who'd gotten abortions. To a person, these were excruciatingly tough decisions, and at least one later expressed a deep regret. Importantly, my version of pro-life accepted fully that Roe v. Wade was settled law. It indeed appeared to be, as Supreme Court justices over many administrations upheld it. I was comfortable settling on the Clintonian bargain that abortion should be legal, safe, and rare. Since my early entry into conservative politics those many years ago, the Republican Party has long left me. No longer empowering, it is oppressive, cruel, punishing, and regressive. From book bans to abortion bans, anti-gay bills to anti-immigrant bills, now it markets itself to an increasingly condensed group of far-right absolutists for whom compassion is a mark of wokeism and lifting others up is tantamount to socialism. And that's not even addressing Donald Trump's assault on democratic institutions, the Republican Party's corrosive white nationalism, the propagation of racist, bigoted, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and sexist rhetoric, and the right's embrace of dangerous and baseless conspiracy theories, some of which have resulted in actual violence. The modern right's perversion of conservatism has been disorienting, to say the least. I've often felt like an orphan, but it's also put something in sharp relief. When it comes to abortion and Roe, as it turns out, my place on the spectrum of views is not only fairly moderate, but very popular. According to recent polling by Monmouth University, only 36% of Americans want to see Roe overturned. Only 33% want abortion legal with no restrictions, and just 8% want abortion effectively banned. Most, 57%, do not favor the all-or-nothing approach offered by the far left or far right. So laws like the one in Texas are unpopular, even in Texas, where only 13% say abortion should never be permitted, even in cases of rape and incest. Overturning Roe doesn't seem to solve an actual problem most Americans have. Abortion rates haven't skyrocketed. In fact, they've been falling steadily over time, thanks in part to increased access to contraception. And a federal ban on abortion doesn't really protect the unborn. It would still allow individual states to decide whether abortions can be performed and with what restrictions, which would presumably drive abortion seekers to those states in which it were legal. To the contrary, overturning Roe would likely add problems, like limiting access to abortion for women in rural and poor communities, where healthcare is already scarce or too expensive. Criminalizing abortion for women who are rape or incest victims is just re-victimizing them. When a society believes women should make the choice between prison and carrying their rapist baby, we can no longer call ourselves civilized. And creating a new body of abortion police and prosecutors to hunt down the procurers of illegal abortions is draconian and puritanical. None of this would be good for America. Like so many other political issues, we're not talking about abortion in ways that solve problems either. If you were only to listen to the loudest voices in the room, you'd think the extremists and absolutist positions were the popular ones instead of the outliers that they are. I've long believed both sides have gotten it wrong when it comes to messaging abortion. The decades-old scenes of protesters outside of abortion clinics yelling at women and abortion providers, "Murderer," and "You're going to hell," were always chilling and seemed like an ill-fated strategy. Whose mind is going to be changed by calling them a murderer? But changing hearts and minds on any issue has become a forgotten, if totally abandoned, exercise in politics, where the only goal is not to identify converts, but seek to out the heretics and burn them at the proverbial stake. We'll never solve problems that way. Take gun violence, for example. I'm a gun owner who left the NRA years ago, frustrated with its cede-no-ground approach to common-sense gun restrictions. But calling law-abiding gun owners murderers after a tragic shooting isn't going to get them to the table where you need them to pass any meaningful legislation. The right treats abortion proponents the way the left treats law-abiding gun owners. Neither are criminals, but both have blood on their hands if you ask their opposition. This only hardens and incites the very people you're trying to persuade. After decades of being called murderers, the pro-choice movement only radicalized its messaging, unsurprisingly. The Democratic Party, under which Clinton coined the phrase legal, safe, and rare, removed the rare part from its official party platform in 2012, and the pro-choice movement has attacked adopters as impure and insufficiently pro-abortion. Efforts like Shout Your Abortion, a social media campaign designed to minimize and normalize what is often a traumatic decision for women, and let's not forget the end of an unborn life, seem not only distasteful but unnecessary. The American voting population already supports legal abortion. There's no need to celebrate it as if it's a fun milestone like getting your ears pierced. Dehumanizing a deeply human experience and detaching it from the loss it involves diminishes the value of all lives. Over the course of 5 decades, popular culture depictions of abortion have, interestingly, handled the issue with much more nuance and sensitivity than we have in politics. In 1972, the hit Norman Lear sitcom Maude featured a 47-year-old title character wrestling with the decision to have an abortion. That decision was presented honestly, with Maude torn, supported by her daughter and husband, but offered a differing opinion by a friend. In 1987, the hit movie Dirty Dancing, set in the early 1960s, deals with the trauma and health risks of back-alley abortions. In 1996, Julia from the Gen X drama Party of Five finds out she's pregnant. She goes through a gamut of emotions. Her boyfriend wants to keep the baby and at least be a part of the decision-making. She considers adoption. Her siblings offer her an array of opinions. In the end, she has a miscarriage. In 2001, Sex and the City, a show that tried to push the boundaries of sexual norms, handled abortion in shockingly conservative terms. Miranda, the high-powered lawyer, finds herself pregnant after one night with Steve the bartender. While she initially plans to get an abortion, after some soul-searching and discussion with friends, she decides she can't go through with it and decides to keep the baby. Meanwhile, her friends admit to having had abortions and share their experiences. In 2007, the film Juno deals with teen pregnancy as a high school girl visits an abortion clinic and ultimately decides to give up her baby for adoption. That same year, in the Judd Apatow comedy Knocked Up, the irresponsible, unemployed, pot-smoking friends of Ben are uncomfortable even saying the A-word when he gets Allison, a one-night-stand encounter, pregnant. Instead, one suggests she get a schmashmortion. Others encourage him to keep it. All these depictions covered the contours of a complex issue more accurately and sympathetically to both sides than the extremes of either party routinely do. Compassion and nuance in politics are in short supply these days. Neither are politically profitable. Fear, division, and keeping systems broken are incentivized. You don't win new voters today by finding common cause with the opposite side. You can't fundraise on problems if you solve them. Fear is the ultimate turnout machine. This is gross and lamentable, but it's also why so many American voters don't believe the two parties adequately represent them. A 2019 NBC News Wall Street Journal poll showed a paltry 11% of voters thought the two-party system works fairly well. A lack of compassion, particularly in the abortion debate, is driving our rhetoric to awful extremes. While I don't think flippant and celebratory attitudes toward abortion from the left are helpful, the right is leading a hideous charge against women with medieval abortion bans and a total lack of concern for women's reproductive, emotional, and mental health. I'm certain that my position on this and saying tough things to the left and right will be rejected by both wings of the debate as insufficiently pro-choice or pro-life. But that's where most voters actually are, in an inconvenient box that's hard to exploit for political gain. I might be a lonely conservative who's rejected today's Republican Party, and I've been rejected by it, but on abortion, I'm also a woman like millions of others in America. I'm somewhere in the middle and firmly in the majority, and yet it feels as though I am completely unseen. Our next article by Anais Mitchell, as told to Ryan DeAugustino, is titled Back to the Farm, Anais Mitchell's Watershed Year. I did more hiking in the summer of 2020 than in the rest of my life combined. I know I'm not the only one. In those early months of the pandemic, it seemed like everyone was looking for an escape. Sometimes we'd drive by the trailhead, see a line of cars, and continue on, thinking too risky. But hiking was literally, physically what I needed. I was trying to get back in shape after my second pregnancy and trying to fill some of the long hours of those unprecedented days with my family. But it was also somehow metaphorically important. To strive for a mountain peak, enjoy the brief vista, and then head home felt like a microcosm of what was happening in my life during this watershed year in my life, in all our lives. In the spring of 2019, Hadestown, the musical I had worked on for a third of my life, went up on Broadway. I'd started writing it in my mid-20s, and it's a sung-through musical, so the writing encompassed music, lyrics, and book. I lived with it for a dozen years in various forms, a DIY community theater project in Vermont, a studio album and a touring concert, a series of workshops and productions off-Broadway and out of town. And finally, it landed at the Walter Kerr on 48th Street, a historic theater with a hyperactive marquee that flashed Hadestown. My name was up there too, surreally. I had just turned 38 and was living in Brooklyn with my partner and our daughter. A funny thing happens to a writer the night a show opens. Suddenly, there was no place for me at the theater. Literally, the seat where I used to watch rehearsals, the stairwell where I played guitar, the usher's office where I worked on rewrites, all of them were occupied. Deeper than that, there was no need for me to be there. It was the strangest feeling. I remember soon after the show opened, it dawned on me that I didn't even need to be in New York City anymore. We could leave if we wanted to. but I pushed the thought away. After all, we just upgraded from the one bedroom with no sink in the bathroom we'd lived in for years. Our kid was in a great public school. We built a whole life in Brooklyn. A lot of people moved to New York in their early 20s, but that's not the way it worked out for me. My partner Noah and I got married pretty young and bought this weird old farmhouse in central Vermont, a few hours from where I grew up. Noah had a collectively owned cafe, bar, music venue, and that was where we spent our 20s, living in a cool small town with a vibrant art scene. We would say to each other, "See, we don't have to move to Brooklyn. It's all happening in Montpelier." The first version of Hadestown was a DIY community theater project. My earliest collaborators and all the performers were local folks, musicians, and singers from Vermont bands. The whole thing really came out of the cabin fever feeling of, we gotta make our own fun up here. But New York has a gravitational pull. I started getting gigs there in venues like The Living Room, a tiny space on the Lower East Side. I had a series of shitty small cars, and I would drive the 5 hours down from Montpelier to play for tips. There would be a few people in the audience, mostly friends. I'd get maybe $35, then I would get in my car and drive back to Vermont. Later, I found myself working on records in Brooklyn and got to know and love the neighborhoods of Carroll Gardens, Park Slope, and Gowanus. Finally, I met some people in the city who it seemed could help me realize my dream of developing Hadestown into a full-length professional musical. So we finally moved to New York in our 30s. We lived in Brooklyn for 7 years, not quite consecutively. I thought we might eventually, maybe possibly someday, move back to Vermont, but it was definitely not in the 5-year plan. In early March 2020, I was 9 months pregnant with our second child. One weekday, we went out for a walk in Prospect Park with our older daughter. The news about the coronavirus was growing scarier, and something told us to keep her home from school that day. On our walk, she was touching a lamppost, and I said, "Don't touch that." I thought, why am I telling her she can't touch a lamppost? Wait, can she touch a lamppost? This is crazy. At that moment, the thought of giving birth in the city, then having a tiny infant and being in the postpartum phase while being locked down in an apartment, I didn't want to do it. I made an extremely last-minute, strong pregnant woman decision and said to Noah, "We need to buy a car and then we need to drive it out of here." And we did. We left on the day Broadway went dark, and Rosetta was born a week later. She was born at home on my parents' farm, attended by some of the same amazing people who had helped bring our first child into the world 7 years before. My parents bought the farm in 1972, young suburban hippies going back to the land. There was just one structure at the time, an old barn near the road that they converted to a living space, where we lived until I was 5, and where my brother's family now resides. A few years later, my grandparents moved to the land. My grandfather built a craftsman home a few hundred yards deeper into the property. And then in 1986, my father built the house I grew up in and where my parents still live. I have impressionistic memories of my dad pouring the concrete foundation and looking at paint colors for my new room. Growing up, my grandparents' house just down the driveway was my happy place. I could always run over and get spoiled for a few hours doing crafting projects with my grandma over a bowl of summer strawberries and fresh cream. I have a lot of sensory memories from that house. The scent of my grandma's cooking and the sound of her sewing machine, my granddad watching TV, the birds and the breeze and the sun coming in through the sliding glass door. And I'm lying on the carpet and playing a game until I get frustrated about one thing or another and run out into the garden where I could just be. The house had become home to a preschool after my grandparents died, and when COVID shut down the schools, we moved into it with our 6-year-old and her newborn sister. We talked about returning to Brooklyn, where our lease was about to expire. We also considered the Hudson Valley, where a lot of musician friends live. But little by little, we started to fall in love with the idea of staying in Vermont on the farm. A multi-generational situation. I remembered what it was like for me as a kid, how freeing it was to run and run and run. So much freedom. We were coming from the city where you can't let your kids out of your sight because a car could run them over every second. On the farm, it was radical to see my daughter just run across the fields. Just running across the fields. We decided to move back permanently. Noah was the one who pushed it more. I think it had to be that way. If it were me dragging him into staying at my parents' farm, it wouldn't be cool. He's a gentle, nature-oriented, spiritual person. He grows vegetables, he meditates, it's perfect for him. Not that it wasn't scary, for me anyway. I was confronting the grown-up I had become, confronting my childhood and all the trappings of it. My parents, my brother, my childhood friends, my English teacher from 7th grade who I'm going to run into in town. We all have the ability to revert to our childhood dynamics, but it's tough to encounter some of these things. Your dad say, how are we going to communicate now that I'm 40 and you're 73? Again and again, having to remember that I'm a grown-up now and what that feels like. In New York, it felt like everyone was ageless. The fear was good, though, motivating. Like, I started doing Zoom therapy, and I had never done therapy in my life because I was always so busy. And anyway, I was totally fine. Therapy has been powerful. And I started to take violin lessons, also on Zoom, from the same man I took violin lessons from when I was 7. He was still teaching in town, and it was joyful to pick it up again with him, to be a grown-up with him. That first summer, 2020, a musician friend reached out and suggested that I do a thing I never thought I would do. Join a small group in which the members commit to writing a song a day for a week. Each night you have to email a recording of that day's song. If you don't submit a song one day, you are lovingly but firmly excused from the group for the rest of the week. You gotta show up. My initial response to the invitation? No, that's not how I operate, I told myself. That's not how I write. I had created an identity for myself as a writer. I'm slow, I'm painstaking, and it has to be hard, and it has to take years. Then I thought about my friend Felix. He was a musician I had come up with, going back to those early days playing for tips and half-empty bars. Felix died in the summer of 2020, not from COVID, although it felt like part of that wretched COVID year because it was unexpected and no one could mourn him or even know what was happening because we were all so isolated. When we were young, Felix had made an album for which he wrote 50 songs in 50 days and put the best of them on the record. And I always was jealous of that. The songs were so great because they weren't overthought. They're just hard on the sleeve beautiful, and I can't do that. I knew I had to say yes to the group, and I was glad I did. It turned out to be a healing process during that tough, tough era. The practice of having to say yes to whatever idea was breaking through, to trust whatever the idea was. There was something about getting access to that flow. Almost all the songs on this new record came from that time. Real World I wrote in an hour and a half. I remembered what it felt like to trust the mystery and the muse. And that remembrance made me realize, okay, there's an intelligence here that doesn't have to be of my own mind or making. I returned to fragments I had been sitting on. Little Big Girl was a song I had been sitting on for 5 years. I know how to finish this now. It was like a dam bursting. It didn't feel that way in the moment, didn't feel torrential. But when I look back at it, it was. We're scared to do that kind of thing. I think, I know I was. But the reason it's scary is the reason it's good. There are things you have access to in that naked place of vulnerability that you would not have access to with months of careful deliberation. And then when I recorded these songs in the studio, it was like they were still warm. I recorded them right away, afraid of what would happen if I looked too closely or got up in my head about them. When the world is functioning normally, when I write a new song, I might play it out on tour for a year. I develop an idea of how I should sing it, which chords to emphasize, what it should sound like on the record. But this time, it was all brand new. I was right there in the studio with the team saying out loud, what key should this be in? Do you guys like this line better, or should I change that word? It felt like discovery. I hope I'm going to write a lot more in Vermont. I think that's the point. That's the engine of my creative life, actually writing songs, not doing email or whatever it is we all do. I hope we'll travel. I hope we'll go back to New York sometimes. But the farm is a literal home and a spiritual home. There's no place in the world that's going to feel like that for me. During my intensive reacquaintance with hiking in 2020, I remembered an area where I used to go with my high school boyfriend to make out and read poetry on a blanket in the field. I actually texted him to find out the name of the place, which I had forgotten. He wrote back, "It's called the Watershed." I took my family there, strapped the baby on, and walked back through a lot of years. I kept turning that word over in my mind, finding it beautiful. I love words that are jammed together. Backroads, watershed. And it was beautiful because the thought that kept passing through my mind was, I'm at a watershed in my life. I wrote a song called Watershed. Nobody gives you a map on the ridge. You climb one mountain and you find the next. Follow the river to the fountainhead. Watershed. The tallest summit you look up to, someday it's going to look small to you. There's a new one coming into view, and you'll climb that too, but before you do, you get time to stand looking off the ledge, where the rivers branch to the east and the west, and to catch your breath at the sight of it. How the heights on which your heart was set, that you won so hard and lost so fast, are now somehow just silhouettes. You stop and bend in the light that's left, and you cup your hands in the riverbed. Watershed. And then you'll keep climbing step by step, by the grace of God and by your own sweat, and a river of tears that you won't forget, but you will forgive if you haven't yet. 'Cause they carved the path that you had to tread, and they'll do it again for the path ahead. And the heaven you seek is not separate from the heart that speaks when your cheeks are wet. Watershed. New York was behind me. Hadestown was behind me. My life with just one kid was behind me. I didn't know what was next, but I felt like I had emerged from years of hiking in the woods. Years of never being able to see above the trees, my head in a notebook trying to find a rhyme for some verse in one of the epics of Orpheus. And then finally being able to see again. You can't see many stars in Brooklyn, and one night, not long after we had arrived in Vermont, while my new baby slept, I walked out on the deck, looked up, and saw more stars in the black sky than I ever remember seeing in my life. These watershed moments, you don't get that many of them. Our next article by Holly Brubach is titled, Why Do People Resist Change? These researchers figured it out and had a breakthrough. This article first appeared as You Don't Need More Willpower in the January 2009 issue of O, the Oprah magazine. This past fall, 24 people gathered for a workshop at Harvard University, among them members of the university's Human Resources Department, executives from nonprofit institutions, one labor union official, members of a prominent international consulting firm, a high school principal, a teacher, and me. We had signed up for the session to better understand why people struggle to make significant changes. Why, for instance, their vows to improve their lives are so often followed, sometimes in a matter of weeks or even days, by utter failure. The workshop is led by clinical psychologist Robert Keegan, PhD, and Lisa LaHaye, EdD, experts in adult learning at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. They've spent more than 20 years wondering why it is that people don't change, studying those, the few, who have successfully broken a habit and the many who, despite repeated attempts, cannot. Eventually, they arrived at a theory, the premise of which became the title for their new book, Immunity to Change. In the book, Keegan and LaHaye point to a study that revealed when doctors tell heart patients they will die if they don't change their habits, only 1 in 7 are able to follow through successfully, even when it's literally a matter of life or death. Their metaphor, invoking the body's exquisite ability to ward off disease and invasion, is apt. Our best efforts to change, the researchers claim, are routinely overwhelmed by forces within us. Keegan and LaHaye have spent decades working with small groups of educators who wanted to improve their skills as teachers and administrators. They now shepherd several thousand people a year through the process they've developed. Like their book, these sessions tend to be skewed towards organizations and their leaders, but their method works as well for individuals looking to make changes. Today, under Keegan and LaHaye's guidance, our group begins to engage in some supervised soul searching. They hand us a 4-column worksheet that Keegan describes as a mental map that functions as an X-ray. For the first column, Keegan and LaHaye tell us, pick a goal, one that would make a significant difference in our lives. A New Year's resolution, maybe. Or the promise we've been making and breaking for years. In the second column, they ask us to list all the ways that we routinely get in our own way and resist change. As an example, they bring up a former workshop participant, a superstar CEO they call Peter. Focused, disciplined, the co-founder of a multi-billion-dollar company, he's the kind of person who decides to lose 10 pounds, does it in a few months, and keeps the weight off for years. But he's been less successful in softening his top-down management approach. In column one of the worksheet, Peter wrote that his goals were to delegate more and become more open to his staff's ideas. In column two, he easily identified how he sabotaged himself. By not seeking out others' opinions, cutting off staffers mid-thought, and not empowering them to make their own decisions. What's striking about Keegan and LaHaye's approach is that it recognizes the often good, if poorly understood, reasons for Peter's behavior, and by extension, our own. Our flat-out failure to change is not for lack of good intentions. While we beat ourselves up over our lack of willpower, our laziness, our weakness, our dark side that wins out time and again, Keegan and LaHaye say those change-resistant behaviors have a very good reason for being. Says LaHaye, it's a protection of something you feel vulnerable about. What lies underneath the surface is anxiety, which Keegan and LaHaye explain they have come to appreciate as the most important and least understood private emotion in public life. Most of us think of anxiety as panic attacks or stage fright, acute episodes brought on by a big presentation to the boss or some other high-stakes occasion, or a condition specific to people who were traumatized as children or survived a harrowing event. But Keegan and LaHaye see anxiety as our brain's background noise, revving up when we're confronted with something new, unfamiliar, or threatening to what we believe, and operating most of the time at such a low volume that we don't even hear it. We all have anxiety just by virtue of being human, LaHaye says. We don't think of ourselves as continually fearful, Keegan says, because we've figured out how to manage this undercurrent of anxiety, whether it's our discomfort at meeting new people or our worry when talking to the boss. For instance, I may have a deep-running anxiety that you don't think well enough of me, says Keegan. But I don't live my life every day like I'm walking on eggshells because I'm very tuned in to what you want or need in order to continue to have a high opinion of me. I use my energy to make sure that I keep delivering what I believe it is that you want. As a result, I don't feel the anxiety because I'm handling it. At this point in our session, Keegan and LaHaye turn the discussion to column three to identify our own buried anxiety. They ask us, what would happen if we stopped the behavior that gets in the way of achieving the goals we've set for ourselves? The room goes quiet. That simple question triggers a litany of potential catastrophes, which turn out to be surprisingly personal. As Keegan and LaHaye explain in their book, this is the moment Peter, the CEO, realized that if he did delegate, he would lose the sense of himself as the super problem solver, the one who knows best, the one who is in control yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Keegan and LaHaye give examples of other clients who resort to the same problem behavior, each of them in response to different obscured anxieties. One woman eats too much because she doesn't like the overtly sexual way men respond to her when she's thin. One man binges as a way of accepting the love of his big Italian-American family. Keegan and LaHaye are in awe of the ingenuity with which we, all of us, keep our lives under control to make sure that our anxiety is kept at bay and our fears never come true. And life could just go on that way, Keegan says, except that the system, this anxiety management system you've built, charges rent. It's costing you something. And what does it cost you? It costs you your goal. It can also cost you the ability to see another person's perspective if it is a threat to the control you've manufactured to keep your fears away. It takes a little time for our group to get to the bottom of the anxiety that motivates each of us. Then Keegan and LaHaye lead us through the last step. They urge us to reframe our fears in the context of the big assumptions that underlie them, ideas we take for granted about the way the world works and our place in it. Our parents convey to us their understanding of life, Keegan and LaHaye explain, and we often take their opinions as fact. For Peter, the belief that needed to be challenged was, if I want something done right, I have to do it myself. For all its intelligence, our psychological immune system is not infallible. Like our physical immune system, it sometimes sounds the alarm in situations when it shouldn't. Traditional psychotherapy trusts that the truth will set the patient free, that the power of insight will overhaul the behavior you're looking to change. Keegan and LaHaye ask us to devise experiments, starting out small, to test our assumptions. Someone like Peter, who is trying to break a lifelong control habit, might choose to delegate a task that isn't life or death to the most capable member of his staff and see what happens. Someone else might decide to say no to a dear friend and see how he or she responds. Surviving tests like these, Keegan and LaHaye tell us, put you in a position to question ideas you've understood as universal truths, and with those changes in your mindset come changes in your behavior. In their years of experience, Keegan and LaHaye have seen people make enormous shifts. To our group, this kind of transformation feels daunting but promising. For the first time, we understand what we are up against, not the evil within us, but our own ingenuity, well-meaning but misguided. What a relief that turns out to be. Not a solution, but a place to start. Our next article by Mariel Marlis is titled, Inexpensive Hobby Ideas to Help You Discover a New Passion. If your days are feeling monotonous or dull, you're not alone. When was the last time you tried something new? Work and other obligations can often prohibit creativity from blossoming. Due to our product and success-driven world, it's common for people to forget that not everything must have a tangible outcome. In fact, it's an important part of life to pursue activities and ventures that make us happy, just because. At the end of the day, the process is the point. A positive outcome or achievement is just an additional bonus. Number one, teach yourself how to roller skate. Roller skating is such a timeless American hobby, and with the pandemic, it made a proud comeback. So trade in your bike for a new pair of blades. Just don't forget to buy the safety wear. If you're just learning, you will fall. Number two, pick up a new book. Do you purchase new books regularly but never get around to reading them? No judgment. We do the same. Here's a new goal. Stop buying and start reading. You have to begin somewhere, and discovering a new universe through fiction, poetry, science fiction, or another genre is the best way to pass the time and learn something new. Number three, learn an instrument. You're never too old to learn an instrument, like piano. In fact, there are so many great resources online, like YouTube videos, that you may not even have to invest in lessons right away. Who knows, you could be the life of the party at your next family or friend gathering. Number four, practice journaling daily. Journaling your thoughts and feelings can help you to better understand them and your mental health as a whole. And if you don't feel called to go deep, write down what's currently happening in your life. It can be interesting to look back on later to see how you have grown with regard to your friends, career, etc. Number five, paint a picture. Buy some craft store paint and a canvas and have fun. Don't overthink painting. There are no rules, so just enjoy the pretty colors and get silly. The process is the point. Number six, learn a new language. While learning a new language can feel like a great undertaking, the goal doesn't have to be fluency. Challenging yourself and learning about a new culture is a reward in and of itself. Not every pursuit needs a tangible outcome. Number seven, take a hike. Ground yourself in the great outdoors and take a hike. Trails can take you through beautiful areas and allow you to explore nature in a new and exciting way. Plus, it's a great way to get exercise and has major health benefits. Number eight, practice yoga. Increased flexibility, muscle strength, and weight loss are all obvious health benefits of yoga. It's great to practice yoga over an extended period of time, as you'll slowly improve your breathing and ability to hold different poses. Number nine, create a garden. Gardening is an easy way to connect with nature, plus you never have to stop. You can garden well into your old age, with a few modifications. Still not convinced? Studies have shown that there are major health benefits, like decreasing your risk of dementia. Number 10, learn how to DJ. If you have a passion for music and love bringing people together, try DJing as your next hobby. This is such a fun one to learn, and the equipment may not be as expensive as you think. Number 11, put together a puzzle. Puzzles is such an easy hobby to begin. It's a mental exercise, as it requires you to use both the right and left sides of your brain. Additionally, it's known to increase your IQ and improve your problem-solving abilities. Number 12, cook a delicious meal. Though it requires time and patience, cooking is a terrific skill to cultivate. You'll always be aware of what ingredients are in your meal. Another advantage, you'll host the best dinner parties. Number 13, cultivate your photography skills. Whether you learn how to shoot on YouTube or enroll in a class, developing your photography skills is worthwhile. You'll be able to capture the beauty that surrounds you whenever you want and have those photos as keepsakes forever. Number 14, listen to a podcast. Or better yet, why not start your own? Your voice is worthy of being heard. Krista Williams and Lindsay Simkick, co-hosts of Almost 30, know that all too well. That's why they created Podcast Pro, a course to help you launch, market, and monetize your podcast. Number 15, volunteer. Consider pursuing a hobby that makes someone's life or a cause better through your efforts as a volunteer. It's a great way to contribute to society and help the world become a better place for all. Number 16, take an acting class. Acting is a tremendous opportunity to unleash your creativity. Again, you don't need to end up on the big screen for it to be worthwhile. Take a new class for you. There is so much joy in the process. Number 17, invest your money. While it may not seem fun, investing is a powerful act that can potentially build wealth and increase long-term returns. Don't know where to start? Consider speaking with a financial advisor. Number 18, practice nail art. Nail art is such a fun means to express yourself. Have fun experimenting and discovering a style that suits you, whether your preference is for patterns, eccentric hues, or unusual shapes. Number 19, become a magic trickster. Learn a few tricks and never be bored again. It's a superb way to entertain family and friends. On a deeper level, it can also inspire people to be more creative in their own lives and to believe in magic again. Number 20, learn your family history. Researching your genealogy can make a great family activity and can inspire intergenerational storytelling and sharing. You may even be surprised by your family's origins and history. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is titled, Why Am I Dreaming That My Legs Are Too Heavy to Walk? Dear Dreamcatcher, for a long while, I've very often had a recurring dream, which has recently returned. I find myself with legs so heavy I can't move quickly to my destination, which is very frustrating. Sometimes I'll even be barefoot. I'll be walking or driving with no shoes. What does this mean? What is holding me back? Signed, Heavy Legs. Dear Heavy Legs, I like to compare a recurring dream that repeats over a long period of time to a favorite expression. The unconscious mind is like a vast database filled with memories and associations we've made since childhood. When you want to say something to yourself, that database opens up and your brain chooses images that fit whatever it is that you want to express. For instance, let's say that one day 8 years ago you had an assignment due and were procrastinating. That is dragging your feet about getting it done. At the time, your unconscious mind chose the heavy legs theme for its vast pool of associations in order to encourage your conscious self to get to work. Now, when you find yourself stalling in another life situation, the same expression can pop up again. If this idea clicks for you, ask yourself, is there a recent scenario in which you're putting something off? Let's not get stuck there, though. Since you're experiencing frustration in your dream, maybe this image points not to procrastination, but instead to feeling unable to get where you want to go. Perhaps this isn't a case of avoidance, but rather you can't get where you want to be quickly enough. Have you recently felt impatient to achieve a goal that seems to be taking too long? A work promotion, for example, or a certain relationship milestone? Whatever it is, you wish it wasn't taking so long. In some of the dreams, you describe yourself walking or driving with no shoes. This image may convey that it seems like you don't have the necessary materials to get where you want to go yet. Even though your slow pace is frustrating, movement is still possible in the dream. You'll ultimately get to where you're going, and you seem to already know that. Let's fan this out a little more. Perhaps you use these images in relation to someone in your life who's keeping you from getting where you want to go. That could be, say, a relationship in which your goal is marriage, but your partner doesn't feel the same. On the professional front, perhaps a coworker or superior at your job is holding you back. Your dream may be encouraging you to push back at the person or people who are putting these perceived restrictions on you. I love how you finish by asking, what is holding me back? Here, you yourself have posed the poignant question. This recurring dream urges you to explore what's keeping you from reaching your goals faster. If you realize you don't yet have the tools required to reach your goal, this might provide some comfort. If, on the other hand, this is a story about procrastinating, the simple fact that your dreaming mind keeps experiencing frustration might be just the trick to motivate you into action. Whatever it is that triggers the image of heavy legs, your healthy unconscious succeeded in grabbing your attention. In this way, your dreams lead to brainstorming, and solutions typically follow soon after. We'll end this week with some friendship quotes to share with your favorite people. Be a rainbow in someone else's cloud. Maya Angelou. How about diamonds are a girl's best friends? Nope. It should be switched around and pointed out instead that your best friends are diamonds. Gina Barreca. If we treated ourselves as well as we treated our best friend, can you imagine? Meghan Markle. Friendship is the hardest thing in the world to explain. It's not something you learn in school. But if you haven't learned the meaning of friendship, you really haven't learned anything. Muhammad Ali. Women's friendships are like a renewable source of power. Jane Fonda. The truth is, no matter how lonely you might feel, you're never going through anything alone. You can choose your family. Jennifer Lopez. The best gift anyone can give, I believe, is the gift of sharing themselves. Oprah. Friendships between women, as any woman will tell you, are built of 1,000 small kindnesses, swapped back and forth and over again. Michelle Obama. A day without a friend is like a pot without a single drop of honey left inside. Winnie the Pooh. The best gift anyone can give, I believe, is the gift of sharing themselves. Oprah. Friendships between women, as any woman will tell you, are built of 1,000 small kindnesses, swapped back and forth and over again. Michelle Obama. A day without a friend is like a pot without a single drop of honey left inside. Winnie the Pooh. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.